Disc 6.
Chapter 24. Buenos Aires. Alfonso Ramirez should have been dead long ago. He was, without a doubt, one of the most courageous men in Argentina and all of Latin America. A crusading journalist and writer, he had made it his life's work to chip away at the walls surrounding Argentina and its murderous past. Considered too controversial and dangerous to be employed by Argentine publications, he published most of his work in the United States and Europe. Few Argentines, beyond the political and financial elite, ever read a word, Ramirez wrote. He had experienced Argentine brutality firsthand. During the Dirty War, his opposition to the military junta had landed him in jail, where he spent 9 months and was nearly tortured to death. His wife, a left-wing political activist, was kidnapped by a military death squad and thrown alive from an airplane into the freezing waters of the South Atlantic. Were it not for the intervention of Amnesty International, Ramirez would certainly have suffered the same fate. Instead, he was released, shattered and nearly unrecognizable, to resume his crusade against the generals. In 1983, they stepped aside, and a democratically elected civilian government took their place. Ramirez helped prod the new government into putting dozens of army officers on trial for crimes committed during the Dirty War. Among them was the captain who'd thrown Alfonso Ramirez's wife into the sea. In recent years, Ramirez had devoted his considerable skills to exposing another unpleasant chapter of Argentine history that the government, the press, and most of its citizenry had chosen to ignore. Following the collapse of Hitler's Reich, thousands of war criminals, German, French, Belgian, and Croatian, had streamed into Argentina with the enthusiastic approval of the Perón government and the tireless assistance of the Vatican. Despised in Argentine quarters where the influence of the Nazis still ran deep, and his work had proven to be just as hazardous as investigating the generals. Twice his office had been firebombed, and his mail contained so many letter bombs that the postal service refused to handle it. Were it not for Moshe Rivlin's introduction, Gabriel doubted Ramirez would have agreed to meet with him. As it turned out, Ramirez readily accepted an invitation to lunch and suggested a neighborhood café in San Telmo. The café had a black and white checkerboard floor with square wooden tables arranged in no discernible pattern. The walls were whitewashed and fitted with shelves lined with empty wine bottles. Large doors opened onto the noisy street, and there were tables on the pavement beneath a canvas awning. Three ceiling fans stirred the heavy air. A German shepherd lay at the foot of the bar, panting. Gabriel arrived on time at 2:30. The Argentine was late. January is high summer in Argentina, and it was unbearably hot. Gabriel, who'd been raised in the Jezreel Valley and spent summers in Venice, was used to heat. But only a few days removed from the Austrian Alps, the contrast in climate took his body by surprise. Waves of heat rose from the traffic and flowed through the open doors of the café. With each passing truck, the temperature seemed to rise a degree or two. Gabriel kept his sunglasses on. His shirt was plastered to his spinal cord. He drank cold water and chewed on a lemon rind, looking into the street. His gaze settled briefly on Chiara. She was sipping a Campari and soda and nibbling listlessly at a plate of empanada. She wore short pants. Her long legs stretched into the sunlight, and her thighs were beginning to burn. Her hair was twisted into a haphazard bun. A trickle of perspiration was inching its way down the nape of her neck into her sleeveless blouse. Her wristwatch was on her left hand. It was a pre-arranged signal. Left hand meant that she had detected no surveillance, though Gabriel knew that even an agent of Chiara's skill would be hard-pressed to find a professional in the midday crowds of San Telmo. Ramirez didn't arrive until 3. He made no apology for being late. He was a large man with thick forearms and a dark beard. Gabriel looked for the scars of torture, but found none. His voice, when he ordered 2 steaks and a bottle of red wine, was affable and so loud it seemed to rattle the bottles on the shelves. Gabriel wondered whether steak and red wine was a wise choice, given the intense heat. Ramirez looked as though he found the question deeply scandalous. "Beef is the one thing about this country that's true," he said. "Besides, the way the economy is going." The rest of his remark was drowned out by the rumble of a passing cement truck. The waiter placed the wine on the table. It came in a green bottle with no label. Ramirez poured two glasses and asked Gabriel the name of the man he was looking for. Hearing the answer, the Argentine's dark eyebrows furrowed in concentration. "Otto Krebs, eh? Is that his real name or an alias?" "An alias. How can you be sure?" Gabriel handed over the documents he'd taken from the Santa Maria dell'Anima in Rome. Ramirez pulled a pair of greasy reading glasses from his shirt pocket and thrust them onto his face. Having the documents out in plain sight made Gabriel nervous. He cast a glance in Chiara's direction. The wristwatch was still on her left hand. Ramirez, when he looked up from the papers, was clearly impressed. "How did you get access to the papers of Bishop Houdin?" "I have a friend at the Vatican." "No, you have a very powerful friend at the Vatican. The only man who could get Bishop Drexler to willingly open Houdal's papers is Il Papa himself." Ramirez raised his wine glass in Gabriel's direction. "So, in 1948, an SS officer named Eric Radek comes to Rome and staggers into the arms of Bishop Houdal. A few months later, he leaves Rome as Otto Krebs and sets sail for Syria. What else do you know?" The next document Gabriel laid on the wooden tabletop produced a similar look of astonishment from the Argentine journalist. As you can see, Israeli intelligence placed the man now known as Otto Krebs in Damascus as late as 1963. The source is very good, none other than Alois Brunner. According to Brunner, Krebs left Syria in 1963 and came here. "And you have reason to believe he still might be here." "That's what I need to find out." Ramirez folded his heavy arms and eyed Gabriel across the table. A silence fell between them, filled by the hot drone of traffic from the street. The Argentine smelled a story. Gabriel had anticipated this. "So, how does a man named René Durand from Montreal get his hands on secret documents from the Vatican and the Israeli intelligence service?" "Obviously, I have good sources." "I'm a very busy man, Monsieur Durand." "If it's money you want." The Argentine held up his palm in an admonitory gesture. "I don't want your money, Monsieur Durand. I can make my own money. What I want is the story." "Obviously, press coverage of my investigation would be something of a hindrance." Ramirez looked insulted. "Monsieur Durand, I'm confident I have much more experience pursuing men like Erich Radek than you do. I know when to investigate quietly and when to write." Gabriel hesitated a moment. He was reluctant to enter into a quid pro quo with the Argentine journalist, but he also knew that Alfonso Ramirez might prove to be a valuable friend. "Where do we start?" Gabriel asked. "Well, I suppose we should find out whether Alois Brunner was telling the truth about his friend, Otto Krebs." "Meaning, did he ever come to Argentina?" "Exactly." "And how do we do that?" Just then the waiter appeared. The steak he placed in front of Gabriel was large enough to feed a family of four. Ramirez smiled and started sawing away. "Bon appétit, Monsieur Durand. Eat. Something tells me you're going to need your strength." Alfonso Ramirez drove the last surviving Volkswagen Scirocco in the Western Hemisphere. It might have been dark blue once. Now the exterior had faded to the color of pumice. The windshield had a crack down the center that looked like a bolt of lightning. Gabriel's door was bashed in, and it required much of his depleted reservoir of strength to pry it open. The air conditioner no longer worked, and the engine roared like a prop plane. They sped along the broad Avenida Noveno de Julio, with the windows down. Scraps of notepaper swirled around them. Ramirez seemed not to notice or to care when several pages were sucked out into the street. It had grown hotter with the late afternoon. The rough wine had left Gabriel with a headache. He turned his face toward the open window. It was an ugly boulevard. The facades of the graceful old buildings were scarred by an endless parade of billboards hawking German luxury cars and American soft drinks to a populace whose money was suddenly worthless. The limbs of the shade trees hung drunkenly beneath the onslaught of pollution and heat. They turned toward the river. Ramirez looked into the rear-view mirror. A life of being pursued by military thugs and Nazi sympathizers had left him with well-honed street instincts. "We're being followed by a girl on a motor scooter."
"Yes, I know."
"If you knew, why didn't you say anything?"
"Because she works for me."
Ramirez took a long look into the mirror.
"I recognize those thighs. That girl was at the cafe, wasn't she?"
Gabriel nodded slowly. His head was pounding.
"You're a very interesting man, Monsieur Durand. Very lucky, too. She's beautiful."
"Just concentrate on your driving, Alfonso. She'll watch your back." 5 minutes later, Ramirez parked on a street running along the edge of the harbor. Chiara sped past, then swung round and parked in the shade of a tree. Ramirez killed the engine. The sun beat mercilessly on the roof. Gabriel wanted out of the car, but the Argentine wanted to brief him first.
"Most of the files dealing with Nazis in Argentina are kept under lock and key in the Information Bureau. They're still officially off-limits to reporters and scholars, even though the traditional 30-year blackout period expired long ago. Even if we could get into the storerooms of the Information Bureau, we probably wouldn't find much. By all accounts, Perón had the most damaging files destroyed in 1955, when he was run out of office in a coup."
On the other side of the street, a car slowed, and the man behind the wheel took a long look at the girl on the motorbike. Ramirez saw it too. He watched the car in his rearview mirror for a moment before resuming.
"In 1997, the government created the Commission for the Clarification of Nazi Activities in Argentina. It faced a serious problem from the beginning. You see, in 1996, the government burned all the damaging files still in its possession."
"Why create a commission in the first place?"
"They wanted credit for trying, of course. But in Argentina, the search for the truth can only go so far. A real investigation would have demonstrated the true depth of Perón's complicity in the post-war Nazi exodus from Europe. It would also have revealed the fact that many Nazis continue to live here. Who knows? Maybe your man, too."
Gabriel pointed at the building.
"So what's this?" "The Hotel de Immigrantes, first stop for the millions of immigrants who came to Argentina in the 19th and 20th centuries. The government housed them here, until they could find work and a place to live. Now the immigration office uses the building as a storage facility."
"For what?" Ramirez opened the glove box and removed rubber surgical gloves and paper sterile masks.
"It's not the cleanest place in the world. I hope you're not afraid of rats."
Gabriel lifted the latch and threw his shoulder against the door. Across the street, Chiara killed the engine of her motorbike and settled in for the wait. A bored policeman stood watch at the entrance. A girl in uniform sat before a rotating fan at the registrar's desk, reading a fashion magazine. She slid the logbook across the dusty desk. Ramirez signed and added the time. Two laminated tags with alligator clips appeared. Gabriel was number 165. He affixed the badge to the top of his shirt pocket and followed Ramirez toward the elevator.
2 hours till closing time," the girl called out.
Then she turned another page of her magazine. They boarded a freight elevator. Ramirez pulled the screen shut and pressed the button for the top floor. The elevator swayed slowly upward. A moment later, when they shuddered to a stop, the air was so hot and thick with dust it was difficult to breathe. Ramirez pulled on his gloves and mask. Gabriel followed suit. The space they entered was roughly 2 city blocks long, and filled with endless ranks of steel shelves, sagging beneath the weight of wooden crates. Gulls were flying in and out of the broken windows. Gabriel could hear the screeching of tiny clawed feet and the mewing of a catfight. The smell of dust and decaying paper seeped through the protective mask. The subterranean archive of the Anima in Rome seemed a paradise compared to this squalid place.
"What are these?" the things Perón and his spiritual successors in the Menem government didn't think to destroy. This room contains the immigration cards filled out by every passenger who disembarked at the port of Buenos Aires from the 1920s to the 1970s. One floor down are the passenger manifests from every ship. Mengele, Eichmann, they all left their fingerprints here. Maybe Otto Krebs, too. Why is it such a mess? Believe it or not, it used to be worse. A few years ago, a brave soul named Chela alphabetized the cards, year by year. They call this the Chela room now. The immigration cards for 1963 are over here. Follow me. Ramirez paused and pointed toward the floor. Watch out for the gadget. They walked half a city block. The immigration cards for 1963 filled several dozen of the steel shelves. Ramirez located the wooden boxes containing cards with passengers whose last name began with K. Then he removed them from the shelf and placed them carefully on the floor. He found four immigrants with the last name Krebs. None had the first name Otto. Could it be misfiled? Of course. Is it possible someone removed it? This is Argentina, my friend. Anything is possible. Gabriel leaned against the shelves, dejected. Ramirez returned the immigration cards to the box, and the box to its place on the steel shelf. Then he looked at his watch. We have 1 hour and 45 minutes till they close up for the night. You work forward from 1963, I'll work backward. Loser buys the drinks. A thunderstorm moved down from the river. Gabriel, through a broken window, glimpsed heat lightning flickering amid the cranes of the waterfront. The heavy cloud blocked out the late-day sun. Inside the Chela room, it became nearly impossible to see. The rain began like an explosion. It swept through the gaping windows and soaked the precious files. Gabriel the Restorer pictured running ink, images forever lost. He found the immigration cards of three more men named Krebs, one in 1965, two more in 1969. None bore the first name Otto. The darkness slowed the pace of his search to a crawl. In order to read the immigration cards, he had to lug the boxes near a window, where there was still some light. There he would crouch, his back to the rain, fingers working. The girl from the registrar's desk wandered up and gave them a 10-minute warning. Gabriel had only searched through 1972. He didn't want to come back tomorrow. He quickened his pace. The storm ceased as suddenly as it began. The air was cooler and washed clean. It was quiet, except for the sound of rainwater gurgling in the gutters. Gabriel kept searching. 1973, 1974, 1975, 1976. No more passengers named Krebs. Nothing. The girl returned, this time to chase them out for the night. Gabriel carried his last crate back to the shelf, where he found Ramirez and the girl chatting away in Spanish. Anything? Gabriel asked. Ramirez shook his head. How far did you get?
All the way. You?
Gabriel told him. Think it's worth coming back tomorrow?
Probably not.
He put his hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
Come on, I'll buy you a beer.
The girl collected their laminated badges and accompanied them down in the freight elevator. The windows of the Scirocco had been left open. Gabriel, depressed by failure, sat on the sodden car seat. The thunderous roar of the engine shattered the quiet of the street. Chiara followed as they drove away. Her clothing was drenched from the rain. Two blocks from the archives, Ramirez reached into his shirt pocket and produced an immigration card.
Cheer up, Monsieur Duran, he said, handing the card to Gabriel. Sometimes, in Argentina, it pays to use the same underhanded tactics as the men in charge. There's only one copier in that building, and the girl runs it. She would have made one copy for me, and another for her superior.
And Otto Krebs, if he's still in Argentina, might very well have been told we were looking for him.
Exactly.
Gabriel held up the card. Where was it?
1949. I suppose Chela stuck one in the wrong box.
Gabriel looked down and began to read. Otto Krebs arrived in Buenos Aires in December 1963 on a boat bound from Athens. Ramirez pointed to a number written in hand at the bottom. 245-276/62.
That's the number of his landing permit. It was probably issued by the Argentine consulate in Damascus. The 62 at the end of the line is the year the permit was granted.
Now what?
We know he arrived in Argentina.
Ramirez shrugged his heavy shoulders.
Let's see if we can find him.
They drove back to San Telmo through the wet streets and parked outside an Italian apartment house. Like many buildings in Buenos Aires, it had been beautiful once. Now its facade was the color of Ramirez's car and streaked by pollution. They climbed a flight of dimly lit stairs. The air inside the flat was stale and warm. Ramirez locked the door behind them and threw open the windows to the cool evening. Gabriel looked into the street and saw Chiara, parked on the opposite side. Ramirez ducked into the kitchen and came out holding two bottles of Argentine beer. He handed one to Gabriel. The glass was already sweating. Gabriel drank half of it. The alcohol took the edge off his headache. Ramirez led him into his office. It was what Gabriel expected. Big and shabby, like Ramirez himself, with books piled in the chairs and a large desk buried beneath a stack of papers that looked as though it was waiting for the match. Heavy curtains shut out the noise and the light of the street. Ramirez went to work on the telephone while Gabriel sat down and finished the last of his beer. It took Ramirez an hour to come up with his first clue. In 1964, Otto Krebs had registered with the National Police in Bariloche, in northern Patagonia. 45 minutes later, another piece of the puzzle. In 1972, on an application for an Argentine passport, Krebs had listed his address as Puerto Blest, a town not far from Bariloche. It took only 15 minutes to find the next piece of information. In 1982, the passport was rescinded. Why? Gabriel asked.
Because the holder of the passport died.
The Argentine spread the dog-eared roadmap over a table, and squinting through his smudged reading glasses, searched the western reaches of the country.
Here it is, he said, jabbing at the map. San Carlos de Bariloche, or just Bariloche for short, a resort in the northern lake district of Patagonia, founded by Swiss and German settlers in the 19th century. It's still known as the Switzerland of Argentina. Now it's a party town for the ski crowd, but for the Nazis and their fellow travelers, it was something of a Valhalla. Mengele adored Bariloche.
How do I get there?
The quickest way is to fly. There's an airport and hourly service from Buenos Aires. He paused, then added, It's a long way to go, to see a grave.
I want to see it with my own eyes.
Ramirez nodded. Stay at the Hotel Edelweiss.
The Edelweiss?
It's a German enclave, Ramirez said. You'll find it hard to believe you're in Argentina.
Why don't you come along for the ride?
I'm afraid I'd be something of a hindrance. I'm persona non grata among certain segments of the Bariloche community. I've spent a little too much time poking around there, if you know what I mean. My face is too well known.
The Argentine's demeanor turned suddenly serious.
You should watch your back too, Monsieur Duran. Bariloche is not a place to make careless inquiries. They don't like outsiders asking questions about certain residents. You should also know that you've come to Argentina at a tense time.
Ramirez rummaged through the pile of paper on his desk until he found what he was looking for, a 2-month-old copy of the international edition of Newsweek magazine. He handed it to Gabriel and said,
My story is on page 36.
Then he went into the kitchen to fetch 2 more beers. The first to die was a man named Enrique Calderon. He was found in the bedroom of his townhouse in the Palermo Chico section of Buenos Aires. 4 shots to the head. Very professional. Gabriel, who could not hear of a murder without picturing the act, turned his gaze from Ramirez.
And the second?
he asked.
Gustavo Estrada, killed 2 weeks later on a business trip to Mexico City. His body was found in his hotel room after he failed to show up for a breakfast meeting. Again, 4 shots to the head.
Ramirez paused. Good story, no?
2 prominent businessmen, killed in a strikingly similar fashion within 2 weeks of each other. The kind of shit Argentines love. For a while it took everyone's mind off the fact that their life savings were gone and their money was worthless.
Are the murders connected?
We may never know for certain, but I believe they are. Enrique Calderon and Gustavo Estrada didn't know each other well, but their fathers did. Alejandro Calderon was a close aide to Juan Perón, and Martín Estrada was the chief of the Argentine National Police in the years after the war.
So why were the sons killed?
To be perfectly honest, I haven't a clue. In fact, I don't have a single theory that seems to make any sense. What I do know is this. Accusations are flying among the old German community. Nerves afraid.
Ramirez took a long pull at his beer.
I repeat, watch your step in Bariloche, Monsieur Durand.
They talked a while longer as the darkness slowly gathered around them, and the wet rush of the traffic filtered in from the street. Gabriel did not like many of the people he met in his work, but Alfonso Ramirez was an exception. He was only sorry he'd been forced to deceive him. They talked of Bariloche, of Argentina, and the past. When Ramirez asked about the crimes of Erich Radek, Gabriel told him everything he knew. This produced a long contemplative silence in the Argentine, as if he were pained by the fact that men such as Radek might have found sanctuary in a land he so loved. They made arrangements to speak after Gabriel's return from Bariloche, then parted in the darkened corridor. Outside, the Barrio San Telmo was beginning to come alive in the cool of the evening. Gabriel walked for a time along the crowded pavements, until a girl on a red motorbike pulled alongside him and patted the back of her saddle. Chapter 25. Buenos Aires, Rome, Vienna. The console of sophisticated electronic equipment was of German manufacture. The microphones and transmitters concealed in the apartment of the target were of the highest quality, designed and built by West German intelligence at the height of the Cold War, to monitor the activities of their adversaries in the East. The operator of the equipment was a native-born Argentine, though he could trace his ancestry to the Austrian village of Braunau am Inn. The fact that it was the same village where Adolf Hitler was born gave him a certain standing among his comrades. When the Jew paused in the entrance of the apartment house, the surveillance man snapped his photograph with a telephoto lens. A moment later, when the girl on the motorbike drew away from the curb, he captured her image as well, though it was of little value, since her face was concealed beneath a black crash helmet. He spent a few moments reviewing the conversation that had taken place inside the target's apartment. Then, satisfied, he reached for the telephone. The number he dialed was in Vienna. The sound of German, spoken with a Viennese accent, was like music to his ears. At the Pontificio Santa Maria dell'Anima in Rome, a novice hurried along the second-floor corridor of the dormitory and paused outside the door of the room where the visitor from Vienna was staying. He hesitated before knocking, then waited for permission before entering. A wedge of light fell upon the powerful figure stretched out on the narrow cot. His eyes shone in the darkness like black pools of oil.
"You have a telephone call,"
the boy spoke with his eyes averted. Everyone in the seminary had heard about the incident at the front gate the previous evening.
"You can take it in the rector's office."
The man sat up and swung his feet to the floor in one fluid movement. The thick muscles in his shoulders and back rippled beneath his fair skin. He touched the bandage on his shoulder briefly, then pulled on a roll-neck sweater. The seminarian led the visitor down a stone staircase, then across a small courtyard. The rector's office was empty. A single light burned on the desk. The receiver of the phone lay atop the blotter. The visitor picked it up. The boy slipped quietly from the room.
"We've located him."
"Where?" The man from Vienna told him.
He's leaving for Bariloche in the morning. You'll be waiting for him when he arrives.
The clockmaker glanced at his wristwatch and calculated the time difference.
How is that possible? There isn't a flight from Rome until the afternoon. Actually, there's a plane leaving in a few minutes.
What are you talking about?
How quickly can you get to Fiumicino?
The demonstrators were waiting outside the Hotel Imperial when the three-car motorcade arrived for a rally of the party faithful. Peter Metzler, seated in the back of a Mercedes limousine, looked out the window. He'd been warned, but he'd expected the usual sad-looking lot. Not a brigade-strength band of marauders armed with placards and bullhorns. It was inevitable. The nearness of the election. The aura of invulnerability building around the candidate. The Austrian left was in full panic, as were their supporters in New York and Jerusalem. Dieter Graf, seated opposite Metzler on the jump seat, looked apprehensive. And why not? 20 years he toiled to transform the Austrian National Front from a moribund alliance of former SS officers and neo-fascist dreamers into a cohesive and modern conservative political force. Almost single-handedly he'd reshaped the party's ideology and airbrushed its public image. His carefully crafted message had steadily attracted Austrian voters, disenfranchised by the cozy power-sharing relationship between the People's Party and the Social Democrats. Now, with Metzler as his candidate, he stood on the doorstep of the ultimate prize in Austrian politics, the Chancellery. The last thing Graf wanted now, 3 weeks before the election, was a messy confrontation with a bunch of left-wing idiots and Jews.
"I know what you're thinking, Dieter," said Metzler. "You're thinking we should play it safe. Avoid this rabble by using the back entrance." The thought did cross my mind. Our lead is 3 points and holding steady. I'd rather not squander 2 of those points with a nasty scene at the Imperial that can easily be avoided.
By going in the back door? Graf nodded. Metzler pointed to the television cameramen and still photographers.
"And do you know what the headline will be tomorrow in Die Presse? Metzler beaten back by Vienna protesters. They'll say I'm a coward, Dieter, and I'm not a coward."
"No one's ever accused you of cowardice, Peter. It's just a question of timing."
"We've used the back door too long."
Metzler cinched up his tie and smoothed his shirt collar.
"Besides, chancellors don't use the back door. We go in the front, with our head up and our chin ready for battle, or we don't go in at all."
"You've become quite a speaker, Peter."
"I had a good teacher."
Metzler smiled and put his hand on Graf's shoulder. "But I'm afraid the long campaign has started to take a toll on his instincts."
"Why would you say that? Look at those hooligans. Most of them aren't even Austrian. Half the signs are in English instead of German. Clearly this little demonstration has been orchestrated by provocateurs from abroad. If I'm fortunate enough to have a confrontation with these people, our lead will be 5 points by morning."
"I hadn't thought of it quite that way."
"Just tell security to take it easy. It's important that the protesters come across as the brown shirts, and not us."
Peter Metzler opened the door and stepped out. A roar of anger rose from the crowd, and the placards began to flutter.
"Nazi pig! Reichsführer Metzler!"
The candidate strode forward as though oblivious to the turmoil around him. A young girl armed with a rag soaked in red paint broke free of the restraint. She hurled the rag toward Metzler, who avoided it so deftly that he barely seemed to break stride. The rag struck a Staatspolizei officer, to the delight of the demonstrators. The girl who had thrown it was seized by a pair of officers and hustled away. Metzler, unruffled, entered the hotel lobby and made his way to the ballroom, where 1,000 supporters had been waiting 3 hours for his arrival. He paused for a moment outside the doors to gather himself, then strode into the room to tumultuous cheers. Graf detached himself and watched his candidate wade into the adoring crowd. The men pressed forward to clutch his hand or slap his back. The women kissed his cheek. Metzler had definitely made it sexy to be a conservative again. The journey to the head of the room took 5 minutes. As Metzler mounted the podium, a beautiful girl in a dirndl handed him a huge stein of lager. He raised it overhead and was greeted by a delirious roar of approval. He swallowed some of the beer, not a photo opportunity sip, but a good long Austrian pull, then stepped before the microphone.
"I want to thank all of you for coming here tonight, and I also want to thank our dear friends and supporters for arranging such a warm welcome outside the hotel."
A wave of laughter swept over the room.
"What these people don't seem to understand is that Austria is for Austrians, and that we will choose our own future based on Austrian morals and Austrian standards of decency. Outsiders and critics from abroad have no say in the internal affairs of this blessed land of ours. We will forge our own future, an Austrian future, and that future begins 3 weeks from tonight."
Pandemonium. Chapter 26. Bariloche, Argentina. The receptionist at the Bariloche Tageblatt eyed Gabriel with more than a passing interest as he stepped through the door and strode toward her desk. She had short, dark hair and bright blue eyes, set off by an attractive suntanned face.
"May I help you?" she said in German,
hardly surprising since the Tageblatt, as the name implies, is a German-language newspaper. Gabriel replied in the same language, though he adroitly concealed the fact that, like the woman, he spoke it fluently. He said he had come to Bariloche to conduct genealogical research. He was looking, he claimed, for a man he believed was his mother's brother, a man named Otto Krebs. He had reason to believe Herr Krebs died in Bariloche in October 1982. Would it be possible for him to search the archives of the newspaper for a death notice or an obituary? The receptionist smiled at him, revealing 2 rows of bright, even teeth, then picked up her telephone and dialed a 3-digit extension. Gabriel's request was put to a superior in rapid German. The woman was silent for a few seconds, then she hung up the phone and stood.
"Follow me."
She led him across a small newsroom, her heels clicking loudly over the faded linoleum floor. A half dozen employees were lounging in their shirt sleeves in various states of relaxation, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. No one seemed to take notice of the visitor. The door to the archives room was ajar. The receptionist switched on the lights.
"We're computerized now, so all the articles are stored automatically in a searchable database. I'm afraid that goes back only as far as 1998. When did you say this man died?"
"I believe it was 1982.
"You're lucky. The obituaries are all indexed. By hand, of course, the old-fashioned way."
She walked over to a table and lifted the cover of a thick, leather-bound ledger book. The ruled pages were filled with tiny handwritten notations.
"What did you say his name was?"
"Otto Krebs."
"Krebs. Otto," she said, flipping forward to the K's.
"Krebs.
Otto. Ah, here it is. According to this, it was November 1983. Still interested in seeing the obituary?"
Gabriel nodded. The woman wrote down a reference number and walked over to a stack of cardboard boxes. She ran a forefinger along the labels and stopped when she arrived at the one she was looking for, then asked Gabriel to remove the boxes stacked on top of it. She lifted the lid, and the smell of dust and decaying paper rose from the contents. The clips were contained in brittle yellowing file folders. The obituary for Otto Krebs had been torn. She repaired the image with a strip of transparent tape and showed it to Gabriel.
"Is that the man you're looking for?"
"I don't know," he said truthfully.
She took the clip back from Gabriel and read it quickly.
"It says here that he was an only child."
She looked at Gabriel.
"That doesn't mean much. A lot of them had to erase their pasts to protect their families who were still in Europe. My grandfather was lucky. At least he got to keep his own name."
She looked at Gabriel, searching his eyes.
"He was from Croatia," she said. There was an air of complicity in her tone. "After the war, the communists wanted to put him on trial and hang him. Fortunately, Peron was willing to let him come here."
She carried the clip over to a photocopier and made 3 duplicates. Then she returned the original to its file and the file to its proper box. She gave the copies to Gabriel. He read while they walked. According to the obituary, he was buried in a Catholic cemetery in Puerto Blest. The receptionist nodded. It's just on the other side of the lake, a few miles from the Chilean border. He managed a large estancia up there. That's in the obituary, too. How do I get there? Follow the highway west out of Bariloche. It won't stay a highway for long. I hope you have a good car. Follow the road along the lakeshore, then head north. You'll go straight into Puerto Blest. If you leave now, you can get there before dark. They shook hands in the lobby. She wished him luck. I hope he's the man you're looking for, she said. Or maybe not. I suppose one never knows in situations like these. After the visitor was gone, the receptionist picked up her telephone and dialed. He just left. How did you handle it? I did what you told me to do. I was very friendly. I showed him what he wanted to see. And what was that? She told him. How did he react? He asked for directions to Puerto Blest. The line went dead. The receptionist slowly replaced the receiver. She felt a sudden hollowness in her stomach. She had no doubt what awaited the man in Puerto Blest. It was the same fate that had befallen others who had come to this corner of northern Patagonia in search of men who did not want to be found. She did not feel sorry for him. Indeed, she thought him something of a fool. Did he really think he would fool anyone with that clumsy story about genealogical research? Who did he think he was? It was his own fault. But then, it was always that way with the Jews, always bringing trouble down on their own heads. Just then the front door opened, and a woman in a sundress entered the lobby. The receptionist looked up and smiled. May I help you? They walked back to the hotel, beneath a razor-edged sun. Gabriel translated the obituary for Chiara. It says he was born in Upper Austria in 1913, that he was a police officer, and that he enlisted in the Wehrmacht in 1938 and took part in the campaigns against Poland and the Soviet Union. It also says he was decorated 2 times for bravery, once by the Führer himself. I guess that's something to brag about in Bariloche. And after the war? Nothing until his arrival in Argentina in 1963. He worked for 2 years at a hotel in Bariloche, then took a job on an estancia near Puerto Blest. In 1972, he purchased the property from the owners and ran it until his death. Any family left in the area? According to this, he was never married and had no surviving relatives. They arrived back at the Hotel Edelweiss. It was a Swiss-style chalet with a sloping roof, located 2 streets up from the lakeshore on the Avenida San Martin. Gabriel had rented a car at the airport earlier that morning, a Toyota 4-wheel drive. He asked the parking attendant to bring it up from the garage, then ducked into the lobby to find a road map of the surrounding countryside. Puerto Blest was exactly where the woman from the newspaper had said, on the opposite side of the lake, near the Chilean border. They set out along the lakeshore. The road deteriorated by degrees as they moved farther from Bariloche. Much of the time the water was hidden by dense forest. Then Gabriel would round a bend, or the trees would suddenly thin, and the lake would appear briefly below them, a flash of blue, only to disappear behind a wall of timber once more. Gabriel rounded the southernmost tip of the lake and slowed briefly to watch a squadron of giant condors circling the looming peak of the Cerro López. Then he followed a 1-lane dirt track across an exposed plateau covered with grey-green thorn scrub and stands of arayan trees. On the high meadows, flocks of hardy Patagonian sheep grazed on the summer grasses. In the distance, toward the Chilean border, lightning flickered over the Andean peaks. By the time they arrived in Puerto Blest, the sun was gone and the village was shadowed and quiet. Gabriel went into a café to ask directions. The bartender, a short man with a florid face, stepped into the street, and with a series of points and gestures showed him the way. Just inside the café, at a table near the door, the clockmaker drank beer from a bottle and watched the exchange taking place in the street. The slender man with short black hair and grey temples he recognized. Seated in the passenger seat of the Toyota four-wheel drive was a woman with long dark hair. Was it possible she was the one who had put the bullet in his shoulder in Rome? It didn't much matter. Even if she wasn't, she would soon be dead. The Israeli climbed behind the wheel of the Toyota and sped off. The bartender came back inside. The clockmaker, in German, asked, "Where are those two headed?" The bartender answered him in the same language. The clockmaker finished the last of his beer and left money on the table. Even the smallest movement, such as fishing a few bills from his coat pocket, made his shoulder pulsate with fire. He went into the street and stood for a moment in the cool evening air, then turned and walked slowly toward the church. The Church of Our Lady of the Mountains stood at the western edge of the village, a small whitewashed colonial church with a bell tower to the left side of the portico. At the front of the church was a stone courtyard, shaded by a pair of broad plane trees and enclosed by an iron fence. Gabriel walked to the back of the church. The cemetery stretched down the gentle slope of a hill toward a coppice of dense pine. A thousand headstones and memorial monuments teetered among the overgrown weeds, like a ragged army in retreat. Gabriel stood there a moment, hands on hips, depressed by the prospect of wandering the graveyard in the gathering darkness, looking for a marker bearing the name of Otto Krebs. He walked back to the front of the church. Chiara was waiting for him in the shadows of the courtyard. He pulled on the heavy oaken door of the church and found it was unlocked. Chiara followed him inside. Cool air settled over his face, as did a fragrance he had not smelled since leaving Venice. The mixture of candle wax, incense, wood polish, and mildew, the unmistakable scent of a Catholic church. How different this was from the church of San Giovanni Crisostomo in Cannareggio. No gilded altar, no marble columns or soaring apses or glorious altarpieces. A severe wooden crucifix hung over the unadorned altar, and a bank of memorial candles flickered softly before a statue of the Virgin. The stained glass windows along the side of the nave had lost their color in the dying twilight. Gabriel walked hesitantly up the center aisle. Just then, a dark figure emerged from the vestry and strode across the altar. He paused before the crucifix, genuflected, then turned to face Gabriel. He was small and thin, dressed in black trousers, a black short-sleeved shirt, and a Roman collar. His hair was neatly trimmed and gray at the temples, his face handsome and dark, with a hint of red across the cheeks. He did not seem surprised by the presence of two strangers in his church. Gabriel approached him slowly. The priest held out his hand and identified himself as Father Ruben Morales. "My name is René Duran," Gabriel said. "I'm from Montreal." At this the priest nodded, as though used to visitors from abroad. "What can I do for you, Monsieur Duran?" Gabriel offered the same explanation he had given to the woman at the Bariloche Tageblatt earlier that morning, that he had come to Patagonia looking for a man he believed was his mother's brother, a man named Otto Krebs. While Gabriel spoke, the priest folded his hands and watched him with a pair of warm and gentle eyes. How different this pastoral man seemed from Monsignor Donati, the professional church bureaucrat, or Bishop Drexler, the acid rector of the Anima. Gabriel felt badly about misleading him.
"I knew Otto Krebs very well," Father Morales said, "and I'm sorry to say he could not possibly be the man you're searching for. You see, Herr Krebs had no brothers or sisters. He had no family of any kind. By the time he managed to work himself into a position to support a wife and children, he was..." The priest's voice trailed off. "How shall I put this delicately? He was no longer such a fine catch. The years had taken their toll on him."
"Did he ever talk to you about his family?" Gabriel paused, then added, "Or the war?" The priest raised his eyebrows.
"I was his confessor and his friend, Monsieur Duran. We discussed a great many things in the years before his death. Herr Krebs, like many men of his era, had seen much death and destruction. He had also committed acts for which he was deeply ashamed and in need of absolution.
And you granted that absolution?
I granted him peace of mind, Monsieur Durand. I heard his confessions, I ordered penance. Within the confines of Catholic belief, I prepared his soul to meet Christ.
But do I, a simple priest from a rural parish, really possess the power to absolve such sins? Even I am not sure about that.
May I ask you about some of the things you discussed? Gabriel asked tentatively. He knew he was on shaky theological ground, and the answer was what he expected.
Many of my discussions with Herr Krebs were conducted under the seal of confession. The rest were conducted under the seal of friendship. It would not be proper for me to relate the nature of those conversations to you now.
But he's been dead for 20 years.
Even the dead have a right to privacy.
Gabriel heard the voice of his mother, the opening line of her testimony.
I will not tell all the things I saw. I cannot. I owe this much to the dead.
It might help me determine whether this man is my uncle. Father Morales gave a disarming smile.
I'm a simple country priest, Monsieur Durand, but I'm not a complete fool. I also know my parishioners very well.
Do you really believe you're the first person to come here pretending to be looking for a lost relative?
I'm quite certain that Otto Krebs could not possibly be your uncle. I'm less certain that you're really René Durand from Montreal. Now, if you'll excuse me.
He turned to leave. Gabriel touched his arm. Will you at least show me his grave? The priest sighed, then looked up at the stained glass windows. They had turned to black.
It's dark, he said. Give me a moment.
He crossed the altar and disappeared into the vestry. A moment later he emerged wearing a tan windbreaker and carrying a large flashlight. He led them out a side portal, then along a gravel walkway between the church and the rectory. At the end of the path was a lich gate. Father Morales lifted the latch, then switched on the flashlight and led the way into the cemetery. Gabriel walked at the priest's side, along a narrow footpath overgrown with weeds. Chiara was a step behind.
Did you celebrate his funeral mass, Father Morales?
Yes, of course. In fact, I had to see to the arrangements myself. There was no one else to do it. A cat slipped out from behind a grave marker and paused on the footpath in front of them, its eyes reflecting like yellow beacons in the glow of the priest's flashlight. Father Morales hissed, and the cat vanished into the tall grass. They drew nearer the trees at the bottom of the cemetery. The priest turned left and led them through knee-deep grass. Here the path was too narrow to walk side by side, so they moved single file, with Chiara holding Gabriel's hand for support. Father Morales, nearing the end of a row of gravestones, stopped walking and shone his flashlight down at a 45-degree angle. The beam fell upon a simple headstone bearing the name Otto Krebs. It listed the year of his birth as 1913 and the year of his death as 1983. Above the name, beneath a small oval of scratched and weathered glass, was a photograph. Gabriel crouched and, brushing away a layer of powdery dust, examined the face. Evidently, it had been taken some years before his death, because the man it depicted was middle-aged, perhaps in his late 40s. Gabriel was certain of only one thing. It was not the face of Erich Radek.
I assume it's not your uncle, Monsieur Durand?
Are you certain the photograph is of him?
Yes, of course. I found it myself, in a strong box containing a few of his private things.
I don't suppose you'd allow me to see his things.
I no longer have them. And even if I did.
Father Morales, leaving the thought unfinished, handed Gabriel the flashlight.
I'll leave you alone now. I can find my way without the light. If you would be so kind as to leave it at the rectory door on your way out.
It was a pleasure meeting you, Monsieur Durand. With that he turned and vanished among the gravestones. Gabriel looked up at Chiara.
It should be Radek's picture.
Radek went to Rome and obtained a Red Cross passport in the name of Otto Krebs.
Krebs went to Damascus in 1948, then emigrated to Argentina in 1963. Krebs registered with the Argentine police in this district. This should be Radek. Meaning? Someone else went to Rome, posing as Radek. Gabriel pointed at the photograph on the gravestone. It was this man. This is the Austrian who went to the Anima, seeking help from Bishop Hudal. Radek was somewhere else, probably still hiding in Europe. Why else would he go to such lengths? He wanted people to believe he was long gone, and in the event someone ever went looking for him, they would follow the trail from Rome to Damascus to Argentina, and then find the wrong man. Otto Krebs, a lowly hotel worker who'd scraped together enough money to buy a few acres along the Chilean border. "You still have one major problem," Chiara said. "You can't prove Ludwig Vogel is really Erich Radek." "One step at a time," Gabriel said. "Making a man disappear is not so simple. Radek would have needed help. Someone else has to know about this." "Yes, but is he still alive?" Gabriel stood and looked in the direction of the church. The bell tower appeared in silhouette. Then he noticed a figure walking toward them through the gravestones. For a moment he thought it was Father Morales. Then, as the figure drew nearer, he could see that it was a different man. The priest was thin and small. This man was squat and powerfully built, with a quick rolling gait that propelled him smoothly down the hill among the grave markers. Gabriel raised the flashlight and shone it toward him. He glimpsed the face briefly before the man shielded it behind a large hand. Bald, bespectacled, thick eyebrows of grey and black. Gabriel heard a noise behind him. He turned and shone the flashlight toward the woods along the perimeter of the cemetery. Two men in dark clothing were coming out of the trees at a run, compact submachine guns in their hands. Gabriel trained the beam once again on the man coming down through the headstones and saw that he was drawing a weapon from the inside of his jacket. Then, suddenly, the gunman stopped walking. His eyes were fixed not on Gabriel and Chiara, but on the two men coming out of the trees. He stood motionless for no more than a second. Then, abruptly, he put the gun away, turned, and ran in the other direction. By the time Gabriel turned again, the two men with the submachine guns were a few feet away and coming hard on the run. The first collided with Gabriel, driving him down into the hard soil of the graveyard. Chiara managed to shield her face as the second gunman knocked her to the ground too. Gabriel felt a gloved hand clamp across his mouth, then the hot breath of his attacker in his ear. "Relax, Alon. You're among friends." He spoke English with an American accent. "Don't make this difficult for us." Gabriel pulled the hand off his mouth and looked into his attacker's eyes. "Who are you?" "Think of us as your guardian angels. That man walking toward you was a professional assassin, and he was about to kill you both." "And what are you going to do with us?" The gunmen pulled Gabriel and Chiara to their feet and led them out of the cemetery into the trees. Part 3. The River of Ashes. Chapter 27. Puerto Blest, Argentina. The forest fell away sharply from the edge of the cemetery into the void of a blackened ravine. They clambered down the steep slope, picking their way through the trees. The evening was moonless, the darkness absolute. They walked single file, one American in front, followed by Gabriel and Chiara, another American at the back. The Americans wore night vision goggles. They moved, in Gabriel's opinion, like elite soldiers. They came to a small, well-concealed encampment. Black tent, black sleeping bags, no sign of a fire or stove for cooking. Gabriel wondered how long they'd been here, watching the cemetery. Not long, judging from the growth on their cheeks. 48 hours, maybe less. The Americans started packing up. Gabriel tried for a second time to determine who they were and whom they worked for. He was met by weary smiles and stony silence. It took them a matter of minutes to break down the camp and obliterate any last trace of their presence. Gabriel volunteered to shoulder one of the packs. The Americans refused. They started walking again. 10 minutes later, they were standing at the bottom of the ravine in a rocky stream bed. A vehicle awaited them, concealed beneath a camouflage tarpaulin and pine branches. It was an old Rover with a spare tire mounted on the hood and jerry cans of extra fuel on the back. The Americans chose the seating arrangements, Chiara in front, Gabriel in back, with a gun aimed at his stomach in the event he suddenly lost faith in the intentions of his rescuers. They lurched along the stream bed for a few miles, splashing through the shallow water, before turning onto a dirt track. Several miles farther on, they came to the highway leading out of Puerto Blest. The American turned right, toward the Andes. "You're heading toward Chile," Gabriel pointed out. The Americans laughed. 10 minutes later, the border. One guard, shivering in a brick blockhouse. The Rover shot across the frontier without slowing, and headed down the Andes toward the Pacific. At the northern end of the Gulf of Ansud lies Puerto Montt, a resort town and cruise ship port of call. Just outside the town is an airport with a runway long enough to accommodate a Gulfstream G500 executive jet. It was waiting on the tarmac, engines whining, when the Rover arrived. A gray-haired American stood in the doorway. He welcomed Gabriel and Chiara aboard and introduced himself with little conviction as Mr. Alexander. Gabriel, before settling himself into a comfortable leather seat, asked where they were going.
"We're going home, Mr. Alarm. I suggest you and your friend try to get some rest. It's a long flight."
The clockmaker dialed the number in Vienna from his hotel room in Bariloche.
"Are they dead?"
"I'm afraid not."
"What happened?"
"To be perfectly honest," said the clockmaker, "I don't have a fucking clue."
End of Disc 6.